Well, of course, dummy JavaScript files are used for testing purposes. They're rarely released to a live website. How this one got loose is anyone's guess. The file also features coding to upload a permanent resident card for a Marvel comic book character, Scarlet Witch. There's more on that. And there's more on the NSA event that we can talk about probably tomorrow when we can get our guest on today that we plan to have on today with Kevin Gostola. Sorry not to have him on the show this morning, but we're working on it. This is Bean Air Cascadia for Monday, October 28, 2013. Kathleen Stevenson engineered the show today. Kathleen, of course, is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. Thanks, Kathleen. I'm Chris Andreg. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and thanks for your generous support during our full membership drive.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Vagabond Opera's 7th annual Day of the Dead Bash, the Transylvanian Voodoo Ball. This concert and Day of the Dead celebration honoring the ancestors is coming up on November 1st, 8 p.m. at the Star Theater, 13 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. The neo-gypsy cabaret Vagabond Opera and the Russian gypsy punk band Chervona will play, along with many special guests. Bring mementos for the Day of the Dead altar to honor lost loved ones. There will be a costume contest with prizes. That's the Vagabond Opera's 7th annual Day of the Dead Bash, the Transylvanian Voodoo Ball, at the Star Theater on November 1st. More information can be found on the right-hand side of the KBOO.fm website under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. We now live in a new geologic era shaped more by human forces than those of nature. But the environmental crisis we face today has been underway for hundreds of years. According to our guest this morning, we live now in a 10% world, a planet with just one-tenth of its former abundance. Today we're going to talk with journalist J.B. McKinnon, author of The Once and Future World, about the need to remember nature as it was, reconnect to it as something meaningful in our own lives, and begin to remake a wilder world. James McKinnon is the author of He's the author or co-author of four books of nonfiction, including The 100-Mile Diet, widely recognized as a catalyst for the local foods movement. James, welcome to Locus Focus.
Oh, thanks very much.
Well, you talk in your book, you start out by describing what you consider a rather universal experience, one of finding your childhood wilderness despoiled in time as you grow older. And I wanted to start with kind of a corollary experience of my own to begin our discussion about our reconnecting with nature. I came to the Pacific Northwest over 40 years ago and discovered from my own experience the great dams along the Columbia River, which I took as part of the landscape for at least 25 years until I finally started learning about what the Columbia River had been like before it was tamed by these dams, especially when I learned about Celilo Falls, which was flooded under the backwaters of the Dalles Dam back in 1956. So It took me a while to start to be able to peel back the landscape that was familiar to me to begin to appreciate how wild this river had been for at least 10,000 years prior to my arriving here. And I wonder if we could start by talking about the importance of what is the need to be able to peel back the built upon transformed landscape, to be able to see the wilder landscape that preceded us. How do we do that, and why is it important that we do that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and that was a great example. And I think we have all kind. We have trouble remembering history in a general sense as a society, but the history of nature, when I started looking into, you know, the actual history of the natural world and the places we live, that really might be one of the most forgotten forms of history that we have. And we, you know, we don't teach it in schools. We don't tell it to our children. It's not passed down in stories or in pop culture in any really significant, consistent way. So, you know, as you said, my own book starts with taking a look at the landscape I grew up on, which really felt like a place that had very little history of any kind, and then finding that there was this really remarkable history when it came to the natural world, and that all kinds of species that had been present in the past were not only absent by the time I was growing up, but had been entirely forgotten. You know, they were not spoken of in the community that I grew up in. And what I realized at that point is that when we can, when we do invest the energy and attention to dig back into the history of nature and the places we live, it has the potential to set a higher bar for what we consider to be the normal state of nature. Because if we're looking around ourselves and saying, well, you know, it must always have been something like this, then there's certainly no impetus for us to strive for anything higher.
Well, I find that as one gets older and you watch landscapes change, you can develop an appreciation that might transcend your own experience. I had a friend who was quite a bit younger than me who had moved down to Santa Cruz a number of years ago, and I was hanging out a lot in the Bay Area and driving down to Santa Cruz to visit her, and I was describing how much I hated the drive along the 880 and how ugly it was, and I started telling her how it had been farms and ranches and wineries and all kinds of stuff like that back in the 70s, and she looked at me with disbelief and said, well, I always thought it was the way it was. And then I thought, well, that's the way I felt about my childhood landscape in New England until my father described how many farms there were around the town we grew up when he was a kid. And I had the same experience when I moved to Portland and remembered it as being a very different place than it was even 20 years later, not to mention 40 years later. So I think that as we get older and we see things change, we can maybe begin to understand that things are not always the way they were. But I guess the question I have is, how do we get back before our own time to be able to move backward in time and to learn what was really there and how much abundance has been lost?
I mean, I think the only way is really to actively go back and remember. And that can take the form of the science of historical ecology, in which scientists are really committing themselves to finding out what nature looked like in the past in specific places. It can mean reviving that history through reading old explorers' journals or pioneer diaries, or speaking again to Native American people and what the many ways that they remember the landscapes of the past. But there's certainly no magic way to simply reveal it. It's just something that as a society we have to recognize we haven't been doing. We haven't been actively remembering nature as a part of our history, and we need to start to do so and to represent that history in all the ways that we represent other histories.
Well, it seems to me, my own experience here in the Northwest, like something magical started happening in the early 90s where people, and particularly Native people here, started talking about what used to be. And so that's how I found out about Salado Falls. That's how I started becoming really interested in what the Columbia River had been like before it was dammed. That's when I learned about the Missoula floods and realized that the Columbia River that we know now is only 10,000 years old, and that the millions-year-old river before that was a very different river. It was interesting to me that this conversation started, and I just wonder, you know, what forces changed that? Because we're talking like 22, 24 years after the famous Earth Day of 1970. It took us a long time to start appreciating things that we have been taking for granted. I mean, to appreciate the things we take for granted were not always there. And I'm wondering if you thought about, like, what has helped to change that conversation.
Yeah, I think part of what's changed the conversation is that traditional conservation has run its course to a certain extent. I mean, traditional conservation has always looked at, well, you know, how do we protect these last fragments of wild space, or these last populations of wild species? How do we protect those from human impact? And that form of conservation was incredibly important over the last 200 years. I mean, if you went back to the year 1900 and were looking at the world around you and looking forward to the future, you would really never guess that we would still have many of these beautiful places that we managed to protect, and a lot of these a lot of species on the world, like elephants and blue whales and mountain gorillas and bison, even things like this. You would never have guessed that those would have survived another century, but they did, because people did the hard work of conservation. But now we've reached a point where, as you were saying in the introduction, we have this tremendously human world. I mean, most of the world at this point is given over to human uses and human interests. And we're starting to realize that we can't simply live in an ecologically whole planet if all we do is keep tucking away pockets of it. We have to actually start to rewild some of the landscape that we had allowed for our own human uses. And there's simply no other way to create a coherent ecological planet without starting to integrate the natural world into the human one.
Well, you mentioned in the book some interesting things that I think very few of us have really thought that much about how long this process of humanizing the world has been going on. We talk about the Anthropocene as a phenomenon that maybe some people will date back to the Industrial Revolution. Other people think it's just something that's starting now, where the world is being shaped more by human forces than by natural forces. But in your book, it seems like we go back, if you want to look at really the human influences on the planet, you need to go back to the beginnings of people. So let's talk a little bit about how the changes in the world that we're familiar with now are much older than the last couple hundred years.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think one of the greatest examples of that is the disappearance of the megafauna, or the really great, huge animals over, you know, a ton or more in weight that used to live on all of the continents. And the megafauna that we're familiar with today are mainly, we're mainly familiar with the megafauna of Africa, so elephants, giraffes, rhinoceroses, the huge lions and leopards and things like that. Well, there were species very much like that on all of the continents until the end of the last ice age. And at that point, human beings are spreading around the world and with a pretty remarkable consistency. As people arrive in a new place, as these ancient humans arrive in new places, those largest species simply start to disappear and go extinct. And that, of course, has tremendous impact on the ecology. So when you remove these huge plant and meat-eating animals from a landscape, then all of the different impacts that they made on those landscapes also vanish. So in many ways, the landscape that we live on today and that is familiar to us today was already dramatically changed by human impact long before we really imagined. You know, it was already an Anthropocene world well before the industrial era, when, you know, many of us think that those sorts of dramatic changes began.
Well, a lot of times we hear the disappearance of the megafauna throughout most of the world, we particularly in North America, it's blamed on hunters. But in your book, you talk about it being a little bit more complicated than just saying that the megafauna were hunted to death. What other impacts did humans have that helped to disappear the and drive extinct the megafauna?
Yeah, I mean, we don't really know. There's still some, you know, there's still a lot of debate about how the megafauna disappeared and to what extent it was human beings, and to what extent it was human beings in concert with some dramatic climate changes that were happening at that time. But certainly it wouldn't be as simple as just we killed every single thing. It's more often the case that when one of these large species is removed from a landscape, all kinds of different impacts trickle down from that, or cascade down from that, as the ecologists say. And it might be easiest to understand that by looking at modern species. So if we look at the wolf, for example, in Yellowstone National Park, when wolves were wiped out in Yellowstone in the 1930s, we often think, well, you know, the wolves were wiped out, but it was much more than that. When the wolves disappeared, the animals that they preyed on were released in, you know, to boom in population. And so they began to strip the vegetation off the landscape. They ate even a lot of the young trees that were coming up, so there were no young trees to replace the old ones. Whole forests started to retreat. They ate the vegetation along the riverbanks, so the beavers didn't have enough to eat. As the beavers disappeared, the wetlands that they create began to fade, and with the wetlands went the fish and the frogs and the moose and so on. So even bears may have started to decline because of the absence of wolves, because the animals that the wolves preyed on would eat the berry bushes that the bears relied on. So there's these very non-intuitive kind of changes that can occur from the removal of a single species.
Well, we're talking this morning with James McGinnon, who is the author of The Once and Future World, and we're looking at how the world was many, many millennia ago and lessons we can learn from appreciating the abundance that once was that we have so little of, and how we can maybe help to restore it before it's too late. Well, people, I think, they get used to what they, you mentioned about how there's a baseline for what we think is the way everything was. And I think a good example of that is the density of elk populations in regions that there used to be wolves. And in fact, when there is talk about reintroducing wolves into Oregon a decade or so ago, there was a lot of concern in eastern Oregon that it was going to impact the elk population and hurt elk hunting. So what does it mean when we are so attached to the number of elk that we don't appreciate why there's so many elk now, and why maybe there's a lot more elk now than there were before we got rid of the wolves?
Yeah, I mean, it really means that our perception of nature changes generation by generation. And I mean, you were alluding to this earlier, this generational shift that can occur. And it really is one of the most important aspects of how we see the natural world. And so there's this phenomenon that is known as shifting baseline syndrome, and it describes how we look at the landscape around ourselves as children or in our youth, and we look at the natural world at that point, and we say, well, that is the normal state of nature. And then through our lives, we might recognize changes or degradation to that state of nature. But then the next generation comes along, and their starting point for the normal state of nature is the changed or degraded state of the previous generation. And it continues like that generation after generation. So we really do, within a matter of, you know, 1 to 2 generations, we really lose sight of what the natural world used to look like. And we can become very attached to natural conditions that may have existed really just for a matter of decades. And really the only way out of that is to get back to this process of, you know, recognizing the ways that we forget how the natural world was, and actively remembering what it was like in a condition of greater ecological integrity, I guess it would be the way to put it, and then to raise the bar on what we consider to be the normal state of nature and start to strive towards something that's more full of life, more abundant, and more true to what it was in the past.
Well, I'm reading this book right now called Trees of California, and it divides the trees of California into four groups, only one which is native, the redwoods, and the other ones are the palms, the orange trees, and the eucalyptus. And there's a wonderful description of this big protest in 1970, just a few days before the first Earth Day, where a bunch of college students in Ventura County sat down in front of bulldozers that were widening the main thoroughfare through their town and taking out all these old trees. And they were protesting the destruction of these trees, and they got arrested, and eventually the trees were taken out. So the author asks, but were they redwoods? Were they oak? No, they were eucalyptus. And that was something when I lived in California shortly after that. And at the time, I think maybe I was in California a week or two admiring the eucalyptus before somebody told me they're not native. They came from Asia, and there's some problems with them. And the problems became really apparent in the early 90s when there was a big fire in the Oakland Hills, and the eucalyptus were just like torches, just sending up flames and doing an immense amount of destruction. So since in the last 20 years, people are not so fond of eucalyptus in California anymore. But I found it kind of curious to think about having a big protest to protect the eucalyptus in Ventura County. But it made me think about your story about the red foxes in the prairie where you grew up.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, where I grew up, it was very much a similar kind of story where I grew up on this grassland landscape where the most exciting animal for me was the red fox. It was the biggest, it was the most dangerous and fascinating animal I might bump into. And then when I returned to that landscape and found that it had been, much of the area that I had played on as a child had been replaced by a suburban development, I was kind of driven to the archives to research what I imagined would be sort of a sad history of the red fox slowly disappearing from the landscape. And what I learned instead is that the red fox had arrived in that place maybe only a few decades before my own family did in the 1970s. And it was a tremendous shock to me and to my sense of what's wild and what's not wild. And that really was the start of the journey that became this book. And in some ways, I find it, for example, in the case of the people standing up for the eucalyptus, these non-native and potentially invasive eucalyptus trees, on the one hand, it's heartening because it does show that people still have that capacity to connect to nature and to value it very much. On the other hand, it shows how disconnected we are from the history of nature in the places we live and how ignorant we've become in terms of our ecological literacy. And, those are two, to my mind, a couple of the most serious problems in the human relationship to the natural world today.
Well, here in the western part of North America, we at least have some semblance of the wild, I think, to use as a baseline. But if you go back east where I'm from, I would say that just about everything wild had been extirpated from most of New England long before my childhood. And then you go further east to Europe, and it's a pretty barren landscape. And actually, some of the most depressing parts of your book were describing, I think, the ecology of England, and you were also talking about some areas in Germany around the Weddell Sea. So I wanted to talk about just how far, or let's say the causes of Europe becoming so severed from any concept of what's natural and what's happened subsequently to try to rewild Europe and sort of how that flows across the ocean and had similar impacts on the eastern United States and Canada.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting story. England, I find, Great Britain anyway, I find a particularly compelling case because here you have islands that in history had all of the kinds of megafauna we were talking about earlier. They had a kind of elephant. They had rhinoceroses. They had, there may have been hippopotamuses and leopards in England in history. There were huge elk and caribou and all kinds of different animals there, and those were slowly eliminated as the first human beings settled on that landscape after the Ice Age, and then it's just been sort of a continuation of that process ever since, and a slow degradation. Wolves disappear, bears disappear, the lynx disappears, and then even many of the birds that, as you say, would be familiar to North Americans, such as the fish-eating bird, the osprey. Some of these sorts of animals start to disappear until you have an island that is really it's down to the very little stuff, you know, small mammals and butterflies and hedgehogs and these sorts of things. And now you see something of a turning. You know, there are people over in Europe who are finally, you know, awakening to the history of nature on that continent, and they're starting to say, you know, well, why can't we have some of that back? You know, what have we really lost? And they're realizing that they've lost this thing that's very difficult to define, but that helps decide who they are as human beings. You know, they want some more of that opportunity to contact wild nature again. And what I find, one story I find very interesting there is the effort to bring back the beaver to Great Britain. And this was, you know, it took 15 years of public consultations and studies and effort just to come to an agreement to bring a few beavers back to one small river. So it shows you how incredibly difficult it can be to bring things back once they're gone. And in that process, one of the most revealing things was that when they asked people, well, why would you or wouldn't you want to bring back the beaver? A lot of people say, well, I wouldn't want to bring it back because I just have no interest in it. You know, people had simply lost the fascination for the idea of living with beavers because they never have. They've never done so for, at this point, hundreds of years, and they simply couldn't imagine putting in any amount of expense or effort to bring back something that might as well have been an alien species by that point.
Well, the other day I was walking in this wetland area near our house, which is actually pretty substantial for a city wildlife refuge, and one of my friends pointed out what she thought was a nutria, and then we must have spent 10 minutes watching this critter trying to decide whether it was a nutria or a beaver. And it was actually rather hard to tell because it had kind of a beaver face, and it was really large, but we couldn't see the tail, so we assumed it was probably a nutria. But I was thinking, this is, I guess, the argument here in the United States as opposed to in England, where they can't even get beavers back. Here we still have beavers, though we've done a pretty good job in the Northwest of killing a lot of them. But, you know, we're rooting for it to be a beaver rather than a nutria, which is the introduced species. And it seemed to me to raise a whole lot of issues, like, you know, like the balance and the imbalance in this little urban wetland that we're looking at. So what do you think about the debate between beaver versus nutria?
these are really interesting questions, because I did realize as I went through this, you know, the research for this book, that rewilding a place like North America, or rewilding any place in the world, isn't going to be a process of simply declaring some point in the past to be the perfect state of nature and then working to achieve that. I mean, it's simply not possible to restore nature in the same way that we might restore an old church or an old house to a particular point. We will probably have to come up with something that's much more blurry and more imperfect than that, because, as you say, many of these, you know, there are many, many species that have settled on our landscapes and naturalized here, and in some cases have been here for a very long time at this point, and have in many ways become a part of a new ecosystem. And so I think what we can learn from the past is, you know, it does give us a very strong framework for what might be absent, what might belong on a landscape that's not there now. It can give us a sense of, what in some cases it can reveal to us entire ecosystems that have been eliminated. For example, in the eastern United States and eastern Canada, there were quite substantial oak savannas and other kinds of small prairie ecosystems that were almost instantly and almost totally eliminated when the first European settlers came and were looking for places to farm. And so in some cases, there are whole ecosystems that we can make some effort to bring back to life in places where they are almost totally forgotten. But the other thing I think that history can tell us is it can give us a sense of what a really healthy, whole, natural world looks like. Because when we look back at that natural world of the past, it is just astonishing. I mean, it is if we were able to travel back into that world in a real sense, I think most of us would find it intimidating, the scale of life, and it would seem otherworldly to us, you know, the abundance and the variety that we would find there. So the history of the natural world can be a guide in that sense too. It can say, well, you know, have we reached a point where the natural world feels as full of life as history tells us it can be?
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with J.B. McKinnon, who's author of The Once and Future World. We're talking about what the planet was like before it was transformed by people and how or why it's important that we maybe start moving back a little bit in that direction. Well, you mentioned people not caring about the beaver in England. And in your book, you talk about the need for a real cultural shift, or we are really going to deal with rewilding. And it really struck me a few years ago, I was traveling in Italy with some people, and I was the only one who kept complaining that there's nothing natural here. I mean, everybody was admiring the great farmland and the olive groves and all the beautiful domesticity of it all. And it was so, everybody say, so natural and so beautiful here. And I would be walking almost every day up in this woods near where we were staying, which I wouldn't really call it a woods. It was a bunch of trees and straight lines that were planted by monks probably in the 17th century. And the longer I was there, the more uneasy I was. And then at the end, when we were flying back to Germany and flying over the Alps, and I'm looking down, and even in the Alps in northern Italy, it still had this sense of being really domesticated. So when we are so used to, in fact, in a lot of Americans, when they travel to Europe, admire the domestication of nature there, and they talk about how old everything is and, you know, how civilized it is. And for me, I have a very different feeling towards Europe, but it seems like it's kind of a minority belief in the United States. So how do we, perhaps, while we still can appreciate the great landmarks of civilization, also appreciate how some of that civilization is impinging on something, a greater force that we also need to learn to respect?
Yeah, it's great. Great question again. And I had a similar experience this year where I traveled to Finland, actually. And Finland in Europe would be considered quite a wild, quite a natural landscape. And I had a similar experience as you had to Italy, where I went down to the seashore, for example, and walked in the forest, and it really felt empty to me. It felt there was the presence of absence, as I say in the book, really stood out for me in that place. And what strikes me in moments like that is that We've never had a public conversation about this. You know, I say in the book that we often ask ourselves, well, who is nature? When we're thinking about how we're going to treat one place or another, we're often debating, well, whose interpretation of nature are we going to go with? Are we going to go with logging companies, or are we going to go with tree huggers? These sorts of debates that we're very familiar with. What we never ask ourselves is, which state of nature are we going to live with? We never say, well, of the various ways that the natural world has expressed itself through time, from this incredible richness and a variety and abundance of the past through to this much more simplified and degraded natural world that exists in most places today, which of those do we want to have? Because it really is, at some level, a choice. You know, we need to choose the state of nature that we're going to live with in the future. And I think when it's positioned that way, and we're able to then say, well, what are our options, and we're able to research and lay out the kinds of options that are available, then we can have a real, you know, democratic, vigorous public discussion about the kind of nature we want to live with. And we've never done it. We've been living up to this point on the form that nature takes as a result of our actions. But we've really never had a discussion about what form we want nature to take.
Well, here in Oregon, where it's probably a lot less contentious about restoring beaver habitat than it is in England, and there's been some successes actually in restoring some good, strong beaver habitat. But wolves is a different story, and it's interesting that the people who are the most vocal about restoring wolf populations, and they are getting restored now to some degree in parts of eastern Oregon, so people want to not just restore them, but you know, really help these populations thrive. Most of those voices are coming from west of the Cascades, and a lot of them from the Willamette Valley. And so meanwhile, the ranchers in eastern Oregon are saying, well, what do these city people know about nature and the wilds and ranching and how dangerous wolves are? And it's romance on their part, and they don't understand the hard life of actually living here in the countryside. So how do we balance that? And how maybe do we get the romantic urban wolf lovers to appreciate all the complexities of reintroducing wolves to a very domesticated landscape, actually, of ranching in eastern Oregon?
Yeah, I think we have to respect those voices, actually. I mean, I think we need to understand that that it is, it's not always easy to live alongside, to live with a full force natural world, and it's certainly not always easy to live alongside predators. That, however, doesn't mean that it's impossible. I mean, there are another of the things that we find when we look back at the history of nature is that there are many, many examples of people living human lives and in many cases raising livestock and living out the rural experience in places that had their predators. And in fact, there still are those places today. For example, in the province in Canada that I live in British Columbia, wolves are present almost throughout the province. And, there are ranchers and farmers and all of those other sorts of rural people at work on that landscape. So we need to look at what it is, what are the conditions in which human beings are managing to live alongside predators. And what can we learn from those situations, and how can we implement them anew in places where those relationships have vanished? Because really that is what it comes down to, is rebuilding relationships with the natural world, where we have enough understanding of how it works, where we've made enough accommodations, and where we've recognized that in some ways we need to manage the risks of living alongside some of these species. So it's by no means a simple matter of the wolves are gone and they belong here and we should just, airdrop them over eastern Oregon, but rather that we need to recognize that there's a whole kind of social relationship with nature that needs to be rebuilt, and that's not going to come easy.
Well, I find it interesting, a lot of the arguments against reintroducing the gray wolf into eastern Oregon is that some of the ranchers are saying, well, it's an invasive species, it comes from Canada. And I think this is probably not quite biologically true, but it's, again, they see the elk as being the indigenous species and the wolf as being introduced.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that has to happen is we do have to confront myths and falsehoods, and that, of course, is a myth and a falsehood. I mean, a landscape that's entirely dominated by elk is one that is going to be much poorer in many ecological ways than one where both the predator of elk and the elk themselves are present. It's plainly a falsehood to say that wolves are an invasive species on a landscape where they historically existed. And in fact, that history is by no means ancient in biological and geological time. So there are those sorts of myths that we do have to dispel through research and through public education.
Well, another thing I think that we have to come to terms with when we are thinking about rewilding our landscape and maybe reconnecting with it. I was recently in Banff, and I hadn't been there in years, and I was looking for a good place to hike, and I was going to be hiking by myself, which is something I do all the time in the Cascades, where the largest predators are black bears, and they're pretty scarce, and it's a real honor to see them, actually. So in Banff, of course, the big issue was grizzlies, which abound there. And I had to choose for my little hike a hike that was going to be very populated, kind of places I don't usually like to hike to when I'm in the Cascades here. But it really, I found myself going through this whole process of thinking, oh my God, I'm thinking about hiking in grizzly country. This is a really different trip than hiking in deer, elk, and perhaps a few handful of black bear country. So how do we prepare ourselves maybe for entering this new wild adventure?
Well, I think the first thing we should do is to prepare ourselves is to recognize that it is an adventure and that it is exciting. I mean, I find it a wonderful experience to go out into grizzly country or into these landscapes where you have things that really are potentially dangerous to us. But it is something that we need to do. We need to do it carefully. And in places like Banff, people are starting to realize that, you know, it might not be the best idea to ride your mountain bike through grizzly country with earbuds in playing your favorite music. You know, you really do have to, you have to be a different kind of human being when, you know, in order to exist and enjoy and celebrate your life in a wilder place. And so there's much to be learned from those sorts of experiences. And, you know, as you were saying earlier, you know, you have ranchers in eastern Oregon who are in some cases pretty upset to see wolves coming back onto the landscape. Well, you know, just outside of the Rockies, you have the same situation as grizzly bears are starting to spread from the Rocky Mountains back out onto the plains. And but with the difference that in polling, a lot of the ranchers there have recognized that grizzly bears have a place there, you know, that both people and grizzly bears belong on that landscape. And then there's a lot of discussion about, well, you know, to what extent do we accommodate the bears? To, you know, how do we do it? Should people be paid for every cow that's killed by a grizzly bear? All of those sorts of detailed discussions can take place. But when the starting point is the recognition that all of these species that historically were on the landscape theoretically belong there again, then, you know, then we really have a good starting point for discussing how that can then happen.
Well, James, it's been really great talking with you, and I really do encourage listeners to read your book. I found it to be a very moving read as well as a real fascinating other way of looking at nature and going way back in time to kind of bring us back to the present. So thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And we've been talking this morning with J.B. McKinnon, who's author of The Once and Future World. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week I'll be gone, but the following week we'll be talking with Wen Stevenson, whose article, The Grassroots Battle Against Big Oil, about the ongoing struggle in Texas to keep the Keystone XL pipeline, recently appeared in The Nation magazine. My engineer is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Kurt Weill about an imaginary island called Ucali, which kind of reminds me of the lost island that you could read about at the end of James McKinnon's book, The Once and Future World. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Afro-Caribbean All Music Festival. 9 bands will play genres and rhythms all originating from Africa, including Afro-Jazz, Calypso, Samba, Salsa, Reggae, and others. The event will feature the bands Jujuba, Levina Suesa, Super Mokako, Roots Revolution, and others. The festival will be held on November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd at the TAQ Center, 631 Northeast Grand Avenue, Portland, from 7 p.m. until 2:30 a.m. Come dance for 3 nights straight at the Afro-Caribbean All Music Festival, November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. More information can be found on the right-hand side of the KABU.FM website under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Cascadia Psychedelic Revival Halloween Meltdown. Thursday, October 31st, 8 till 2:30 a.m., 5 bands with psychedelic 60s and 70s influences will play the Meltdown at the Bob White Theater in Portland. The bands featured are The Real, Cody and the Wheel, The Kingpins, Coca-Bola, and Mugspoon. They will be performing with the Vintage Oil Slides Psychedelic Light Show by Liquid Lights, Steve Goldsmith, and the Psychedelic Express. That's the Cascadia Psychedelic Revival Halloween Meltdown, October 31st, at the Bob White Theater at 6423 Southeast Foster Road in Portland. More information can be found at the KBOO.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde Vocational Rehabilitation Program, providing assistance to eligible tribal members with disabilities on regaining, retraining, retaining, and securing employment particular to their strengths.